Wouldn't you know it would end that way? You've just finished the greatest thing that could happen to a human being. And you suddenly discover that the ceiling of the first floor of the firehouse is also the floor of the second floor of the firehouse. You've encountered a new challenge. Dorothy, let's talk about how people approach religion. To an awful lot of minds in this world, and mine happens to be one, the Christian religion is completely lacking in any intellectual stimulus. I think that this book has been written to appeal to a person who finds difficulty separating philosophy and religion. I have great difficulty in separating the two, because when I think religion, I'm trying to think truth. And the paper just defined philosophy as thinking truth. These papers are written, I think, to appeal universally to mankind on earth. And they contain many features and aspects which are very, very foreign to Christian thinking, but not foreign to Hindu thinking, not foreign to Buddhist thinking. I believe that many people will be puzzled. I've heard people in the old days in Chicago saying, "I wonder why that paper was ever written." That particular statement was made about the pair of papers, Physical Aspects of the Local Universe and Energy, Mind, and Matter. And I recall an engineer who I think darn near wore those papers out reading them. Yes. Come.
I want to say subjectively first that there is not one concept in the book that doesn't intrigue me. And, you know, I go along with 100%. Some of them I do not understand as well as others.
I sure
and along
problem.
The lines that we have spoken after seminar time, yes. About the talents that are given to people.
Yes.
They vary. And you were subjective to your conversation by saying, "Dorothy, to me, you know, so and so and so and so." That is your mind.
That's right.
And I have another kind of mind.
That's right.
With a certain number of talents. And you have. And so I feel that is true of each of us on
sure.
Rancha.
Sure.
And there is something in this book today in 1959 to appeal to every kind of mind.
That's right.
And it will be a very small proportion, Bill, that will, like you and Bud, want to know those absolute things. Now, I really feel that.
Well, I've got a job of trying to teach this book. It's a self-imposed job, incidentally. No one ever commissioned me to do it. I got adopted by the Brotherhood, but the Brotherhood didn't commission me to teach the book. The Brotherhood merely commissioned me to act as a liaison. Mm-hmm. I discharged that responsibility in about an hour's time last Sunday. That was my only official thing. I'm here as an uncommissioned teacher by invitation.
And it proves too, Bill, and you do a magnificent job. But you're very, very smart, and as I told you, you've got 10 talents, and just for kicks, I said I had 5, I might only have 1, I don't know. But I do know the concepts in this book, except the absolute, and I had never seen that before, you know, on that very high level, that we may, you know, try to grasp the techniques of the absolute.
That's right.
So, if I'd ever read that, maybe I read it subconsciously. So all I'm saying, I wish someone else would talk to the point, if anybody in the room knows what I'm saying, because, you know, I know so well what I'm trying to say.
I tell you, the different people will teach this book in different ways. I've been intrigued with the difficult concepts in this book. I'm intrigued with others that are not so difficult to understand, darn difficult to live.
Well, we could get a lot more people to study the book, Bill, if we didn't dwell on these difficult things.
Well, I think I should try to help you with the most difficult
things.
I
want you to hit. Oh, you did. Excuse me, I talked before you finished. Okay. That's what you want to do.
It seems to me, if I can help you folks, today's idea was not difficult at all. It's just a beautiful story, and the only help I can give you is the stringing of the story together, like pearls on a string.
All right, why don't we have more people studying the book?
I've wondered that all my life.
Well, let's get to the point, and let's talk.
Yes.
Okay, but
you have just said something.
Well, I'm concerned.
I think.
I'm concerned.
May I say?
We have tried to do nothing but get people to study the book, and it's hard.
Why?
Well, I'll tell you, and Bill, I tell you frankly, the last 2 years they haven't cared to get into small enough units to study. They want to talk. Now, Julia will tell you.
Well, everybody wants to
try out their own theory. It's been a social meeting every time you've gotten together. And you can study the Urantia book in a social meeting.
That's true.
Now, Dorothy, that's the answer.
Well, okay. Then have you tried to get in when you know this to be true, and you kiddingly said to me this afternoon when I was almost out of order what I said.
You were in perfect order. You were expressing what was in your heart.
Yeah, you said, just like in the League of Women Voters, brother, if I was in the League of Women Voters and I popped up with what I did this afternoon, they would immediately give me a portfolio to become a teacher and see if I could
Let's turn this off.
In a matter.
I thought I could hold it against everybody.
No. We're talking very informally, and it has no business being recorded.
Gosh, I forgot that.
You see, we're a victim of two errors of thinking. We idealize and we dichotomize. We idealize and we dichotomize. That is to say, we think in two categories. The good guys wear white hats and the bad guys wear black hats, as in Westerns. And then when somebody gets a hold of something pretty nice, like believing in God, we immediately say, gee, now he's wearing a white hat. And we have that same feeling about ourselves.
Well, no, don't make any statement.
He just wants to know what the
Don't make any statement. Don't make any statement.
Definitely. And so, this is where we set so much store by a conversion experience, so-called, which I think is possible in certain people. I know it could never happen in me. I'm not built that way. This is when a guy takes off his black hat and jumps on it and spurns it and goes into a store and buys a white hat. Well, this just isn't for real. But it sure makes for disappointment. When we get a hold of something like this book, we get a bit, yes?
What do you mean it isn't for real? Don't you think that sometimes conversions are real and genuine?
I said I thought they were, Ruth, but I don't think they go that far to switch from a black hat to a white hat. I'm open-minded, and if I ever see or hear of one, I'll believe it. But I've got to see this or hear of it.
What do you think about Paul?
Paul experienced conversion, but Paul, thanks. I got real meat for my grinder now. Paul experienced conversion, but was still a damn fool on the subject of women.
Oh, yes, but the white hat doesn't mean you're completely white.
That's my point, Ruth. That's my very point. What happens is you never were wearing a black hat. You were wearing a very dark gray hat. And when the religious experience hit you, you took your hat off and you went and you bought one, but the hat you got was only about 2 degrees lighter gray, that's all. It wasn't white. That's right. Now, on different levels, this thing acts in different ways. Paul had a vision. So did Gautama Siddhartha, and these are the only two conversion experiences mentioned in this book. One Christian and one Buddhist. Siddhartha went out and preached a better gospel than India had ever seen, but God still wasn't in his gospel. Paul went out and started living a life which he could look back on and without undue pride just flatly say, I've fought a good fight, I've kept the faith. That's a wonderful statement he made. But consider some of the horrible things he put into his teaching. The atonement, It's better to live celibate.
Marry your brothers.
Yeah, and if you can't take the problem, get married then. Jeez, what grim advice to give the human race. How the life carriers must have shuddered at this guy who's trying to undo all that they've been doing. Fortunately, they built too well. When the life carriers got through with 600 million years of sexual momentum, Paul couldn't stop it. And his comments about, well, he was still a Stoic. Is that his dim view on women reflected the fact that some gal had used Paul rather badly at some time in the past? Women have been known to do this.
Was he married?
No, he wasn't, and he probably would like to have been. So, in a group like this, and as you look inside your own heart, you set up an ideal, and then you fall short of it. And it's dismaying. And if you'll study the 12 apostles, we have somewhere here on tape my inventory of the 12 apostles as lousy guys. And I'm quoting from the Blue Book. All we did was take inventory of all their weaknesses. And they were richly human in all areas, you know? And this is something we have to live with. The fact that we can imagine and yearn for a much better person than we're probably going to be in this lifetime. In other words, our ideals grow geometrically and our achievement progresses arithmetically. And if we lose our sense of humor, we could easily slice our little throats from ear to ear out of sheer discouragement. And I think that's real stupid too. Because while we're an amazing emulsion of good and evil, with, I hope, the good growing and the evil diminishing, the fact remains that the evil is still there, and we can make beautiful fools of ourselves. Here's where I think humor is so all-important, along with worship. If you can only look and see, we are still mammals. We have still endocrines, you know. We have adrenal glands, without which the human race couldn't have survived, and now they make us get mad, you know? Yes.
Don't you think William James does an awfully good job describing that in his varieties?
Of religious experience?
Yeah.
The guy's a genius, yes.
Under Six Souls and the Healthy-Minded Religionists.
Mm-hmm.
Those
yes.
two chapters just describe them exactly. Seems to me he's rather, maybe not, rather hard on the people who are converted by calling them Six Souls.
Well, of course, what James is looking at is so much of so-called conversion, I don't think is. It's emotional. But if you take a person, let's take a percentile scale from 0 to 100. And let's say we've got a pretty thoroughgoing louse who ranks about 10 in terms of human values and, you know, nice qualities. And we'll make him a weeno bum down on whatever is the Los Angeles equivalent of the Bowery or West Madison Street.
East Fifth Street,
all right. And there's one of these real typical missions in there. And there's a guy in there that doesn't have much in the way of brains, but he's got a lot of feeling for God. In other words, he's spiritually motivated. And he's not very bright. But he's got this. And he feeds this character and really throws it at him, and he gets to him. And all of a sudden this guy takes off his black hat and jumps all over it and goes over and puts on a white hat. This is conversion. And for the moment he seems to be registering about the 90th percentile. But there's a big emotional factor. And when we look at him, about a month later he sagged down to the 40th percentile. Listen, I could care less about that 50-point drop. I'm extremely interested in the 30-point net rise. Something real happened here. I don't sneer at conversion, I merely say I think it's overrated. Because there's apt to be a 50-point drop. But if there's any residual gain, this is real. Something happened to Paul, something happened to Gautama Siddhartha.
You and Billy Graham.
Hmm?
You and Billy Graham.
What does Graham say about that?
I don't know what he says, but he certainly uses those methods.
That's all right. Billy Graham is doing Billy Graham is doing what's in his heart to do.
Maybe, and many of
I can't buy Billy Graham, and I can't buy... Who is the guy selling magic in New York?
Norman Peel.
Norman Vincent Peel. I think he's a witch doctor, to me. But if Peel is sincere, and I put a great big if in there, then he's doing well. I feel rather sure Billy Graham is sincere.
Yes, he is.
Yeah, Billy Graham smells sincere to me, and I get a question about Norman Vincent Peel. I've talked to people who've talked to Peel who are in position to raise that if.
I think it's so hard, people are so likely to fool themselves.
Sure.
Intellectual dishonesty is sure. Awfully common, I think.
Listen, I go right back. The only way I know to get wiser is to extend my memory. And that's why I read history so much, because I like to be a midwayer. You know, these people have been around for 37,000 years. Well, I can at least find out what happened as far as it's been recorded. I can push my memory back 4,000 or 5,000 years by really carefully studying. And the thing that glorifies people is the distance of time. You see, we idealize, and that's how we create myths. Because if a guy came out net good, then we want him to be all good.
Oh, yeah.
We want his hat to be lily white. We do this to George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, Thomas Jefferson, and the whole Gishmer, you know? We do this. That's why the paper on the 12 apostles is such a wonderful document. Because they're not debunking the 12 apostles, they're just telling the truth about them.
Desainting them.
They're desainting them, yes. This should be done to all people. I read back about Augustine, Polycarp, Ambrose, Chrysostom, all those old Joes that are supposed to be the founding fathers of the Christian church. And I hate to refer to the church, but what else am I going to study of a religious organization if I don't study the church? It's the only thing that goes back there. There was no Jesus Brotherhood that I could study. The Jesus Brotherhood became a church. And as near as I can see, these characters were pretty human. They made an awful lot of mistakes. Some of them were wishy-washy. Galileo had all the spine of custard when they really clamped down on him. Copernicus was afraid to have his stuff published in his lifetime. He saw his book on his deathbed.
Yeah. Psychology prof, last summer at Northwestern defended Galileo, saying that Galileo realized that he would be more beneficial to mankind to be able to continue his program rather than be snuffed right off.
We're each entitled to an opinion on that.
Yeah.
We're each entitled. I don't know that the professor is wrong. You see, I think this. We've got a problem of attempting tolerance and retaining conviction. If you're not interested in something, it's so easy to be tolerant. For example, Ruth, what you eat for lunch today is a matter concerning which I have great tolerance, because it's your tum woman, not mine, you know. No.
So did my stomach. A lot of tolerance for what I eat.
Well, that's a concern to you. Now, if how can you go about being really tolerant and still have burning convictions?
Yeah.
Now, here I think we've got to look at Jesus in order to get a pattern. He had, do you recall at Pella, when at the encampment, he never told the apostles how to teach. He let them teach each one as he saw the gospel. And then in the evening, he harmonized their teachings. Jesus had in the 12 apostles a 12-faceted lens, which could take the white light of his teaching and come out with a chromatic spectrum. And I think he set value on each one of those hues. As I look at the 12 apostles, they break Jesus up into 12 different hues. And many times in the papers, not many times, but several times, they tell us what each one thought of him, mm-hmm. What they made of a certain episode.
Yeah.
There's a great inventory of apostolic reactions on the day they went into Jerusalem on Palm Sunday.
Yes, that is so enlightening.
All sorts of reactions from a guy that was simply bemused to old Simon Zelotes, who said, "Today is the day we overturn the government." Yes, yes.
Wow.
This is Der Tag.
Bill, they give us so much of Rodin. Don't you think that's because Rodin really knew what Jesus was talking about?
That was one facet, yes. Rodin got the full philosophic impact of the gospel. And you notice that Jesus didn't detail John and Peter to talk to Rodin. He detailed the philosopher among the 12 and the scientist among the 12.
When they went out two by two, the twins go together?
I forgot. I've forgotten there how he set them out. The best pairing, I thought, was the one that I remember best, is up on the Sea of Galilee, where he talked to them two by two. And there, I think, he chose those who were somewhat more similar to each other than to the others. Because to each, he asked the same question: do you love me? Do you trust me? Do you serve me? Do you obey me?
Up until the 15th century, this movement, which was very barbaric because they were burning people and inquisitioning them and et cetera, how did they justify these acts and call it Christianity?
They justified it, Bud, because they had put the church in the place of the gospel. And loyalty to the church was the paramount duty of man. And the church was a self-defining institution. And if you did not accept the church and all that the church stood for wholeheartedly, you were a heretic. And if you were a heretic, you were going to go to hell. And if they couldn't get you in line, they were guilty. They were an accessory before the fact of your being forever condemned. And better that your body burn here on earth than that your soul burn in eternity. Now there's the rationalization.
In the name of Jesus
Christ. In the name of Jesus, yes.
Oh, gee, that gets me.
Isn't that wonderful?
Surely the mores of the time permitted the torture and terrible penal methods.
This is true.
It was accepted.
Being burned wasn't so bad when you consider you could be racked.
Yeah.
Or put in an Iron Maiden.
For thinking, though, this was their only penalty. These people thought.
Yes, yes, Bud.
They were scientists. They
yes.
were. They were philosophers.
Mm-hmm. It's horrible. But I've tried to give you the rationale of the Jebby or the Dominican who lit the tinder. I still fear this church, because this church would destroy me if it could. I know this. This church would destroy me today if it had the power.
To hold the church high.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty powerful.
This is a real juggernaut. It's worth the price of secularism to have smashed that bondage. Now we'll have to attack secularism. Listen, let me tell you folks something. I'm drawing on everything I know from history. And I'm drawing on everything I know about this book, including many, many things that I can't say, but I can give you my distillate. Progress, be it cultural or be it religious, has always been a nip and tuck and very precarious thing. Progress is like walking. And when you walk, you are always off balance. You are always vulnerable. Progress involves such things as needing communist Russia to whip fascist Germany. And then you have to cope with the problem of communist Russia. Progress is a succession of Thermopylae, of last-ditch stands, of Thermopylae that fail, of marathons that come through. Progress involves the tactical duplicity of Thucydides, who gets the Greek fleet so damn penned up at Salamis that they have to fight. This is no great noble thing. The Thucydides cornered the Greeks. They were like rats. They had to clobber the Persians. Progress is a whole series of nip and tuck things that somehow came through. Progress is also a whole series of nip and tuck things that didn't come through. Witness the slow, fighting fall of Rome and how those Romans fought. And I'm with them because they were civilized fighting barbarians. Progress is a little group like this that doesn't look like very much, but it's a beginning. Progress is all of you people with your different personalities and having to put up with me, and I'm a salty character that's not too easy to live with. And I don't know, this group goes forward or it doesn't go forward, and if it doesn't, something else will take your place. This is progress. This is an uphill climb and an uphill fight. That's fun because it's so uncertain as concerns the details and so tremendously certain as concerns the whole.
When did the angels of progress we were to pray for?
Listen, yeah. do you think for 1 minute that at the level of seraphic planetary government they don't have their arguments?
Tell us one right in here.
Let me read you the residuum of an argument I know a good deal about. And it was a doozy.
On the Aramea?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Page 1486. This is a matter of record, but I know of one argument that was even stronger than this. When we the midwayers first prepared the summary of Jesus' teachings at Hermia, there arose a disagreement between the seraphim of the churches and the seraphim of progress as to the wisdom of including these teachings in the Urantia Revelation. This is like a big hassle between the Treasury Department and the Department of Commerce. Conditions of the 20th century, prevailing in both religion and human governments, are so different from those prevailing in Jesus' day that it was indeed difficult to adapt the Master's teachings at Hermia to the problems of the kingdom of God and the kingdoms of men, as these world functions are existent in the 20th century. We were never able to formulate a statement of the Master's teachings which was acceptable to both groups of these seraphim of planetary government. Now, are these 2x4 bickering angels? No. These are angels who have made the paradise ascent and have found the universal father, have entered the seraphic core of completion, are the equals of finaliters, and have returned.
And they still argue like this.
They have been commissioned to argue this way. They are doing their duty. These seraphim, one group, I bet you they could function interchangeably. The religious guardians have been commissioned to guard religion. And the seraphim of progress have been commissioned to foment progress. And they are the official antagonists, Promethean and Epimethean. It says somewhere in this book that you don't get stability by statics, you get stability by contending forces, which work out into a resultant.
With their background, it couldn't be exactly burning conviction then, you mean. They are looking just primarily at one side.
Of course. Of course. Like two honest attorneys debating in court,
yeah,
who are friends outside of court. I'll bet you they drink beer together on the side.
Mm-hmm. But when one's holding up a church and the other swinging this book around, they say,
sure,
your father's mustache.
Right. We were never able to formulate a statement of the Master's teachings which was acceptable to both groups of the Seraphim of Planetary Government. Finally, the Melchizedek chairman of the Revelatory Commission appointed a commission of three of our number to prepare our view of the Master's Urmia teachings as adapted to 20th century religious and political conditions on Urantia. Accordingly, we three secondary midwares completed such an adaptation of Jesus' teachings, restating his pronouncements as we would apply them to present-day world conditions, and we now present these statements as they stand after having been edited by the Melchizedek chairman of the Revelatory Commission. This is not what Jesus said, but this is what they think he would have said had he said it now. And again, on the next page, while the Master's teaching concerning the sovereignty of God is a truth, only complicated by the subsequent appearance of the religion about him among the world's religions, his presentations concerning political sovereignty are vastly complicated by the political evolution of nation life during the last 1900 years and more. In the times of Jesus, there were only two great world powers, the Roman Empire in the west and the Han Empire in the east. And these were widely separated by the Parthian kingdom and other intervening lands of the Caspian and Turkestan regions. We have therefore, in the following presentation, departed more widely from the substance of the Master's teachings at Urmia concerning political sovereignty, at the same time attempting to depict the import of such teachings as they are applicable to the peculiarly critical stage of the evolution of political sovereignty in the 20th century after Christ. Gosh, this next section deals with problems arising in the American Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
Speaks of the United Kingdom, I believe, as well as the United States.
But that first sentence in that political sovereignty, isn't that really powerful, Bill?
Yes. It's complicated by the appearance of the religion about him.
I don't see why those advanced, broad-minded, experienced angels couldn't come to an agreement.
They didn't come to an agreement. Their commissions made it impossible for them to agree. Why don't two experienced attorneys, broad-minded, wise, learned in the law, counsel for the prosecution, counsel for the defense, why don't they come to an agreement?
They often do.
Yeah, but in this case, they didn't. And we can say, why didn't they? This makes a court case. Yes.
Oh, but they settle for compensatory damages and things. They have to negotiate this just like the judge would have to negotiate after he heard the trial.
Right.
This isn't an agreement. This is, I don't want to go to court. I'll be willing to pay so much not to.
Just remember this.
No, it isn't that. It's the wisest thing to do. And why couldn't they use any of them?
You're being idealistic, Ruth. You're idealizing this whole situation. They couldn't agree. At least they didn't. And always remember this. This Revelatory Commission that produced the Urantia book is not above the law. If they got into real hot water with these seraphim could walk into a conciliating commission and come out with an injunction. And the Revelatory Commission would be just as amenable to universe law and the conciliators as anyone else. They could stop them.
On these low levels, there just isn't any solution to something.
That's right. Look.
Even by people
look, let me,
in paradise.
Let me appeal to the toughest experience Jesus had growing up. Do you remember when they wanted him to head up the Zealot movement in Nazareth?
Yeah.
There was no answer to that one.
Yeah.
None. This is the first time in his life Jesus encountered a situation in which he could not tell the truth. The truth didn't fit.
Yeah. I think the same thing is true about pacifism.
Yes.
Right now.
Sure. But analyze that Zealot deal. No.
They really expected him to march through Rome or something.
Yes, of course. Now, a person like Jesus, who is so lovable, is never going to be without friends who can say what they say, thinking it's the truth. And this is pretty well symbolized in Jacob the stonemason's son.
Mm-hmm.
When Jesus wouldn't fight, he didn't suffer too much because of it, because Jacob had a sense of fairness, and Jacob had no compunctions. And I hope he'd inherited his old man's muscular development. I think of a stonemason as being a little on the powerful side. And I'm with Gaynard when he said, I think I would have enjoyed slugging it out with those characters if I'd been around. At the Zealot episode, Jesus was not alone. The old Kazan was in there pitching. And what's more, he had James get up and say some things which James could say and which Jesus couldn't say.
And his not fighting was not because he lacked strength.
No, but simply because God doesn't fight back. And even as a youngster, Jesus had some kind of an intuitive realization that he was not to fight back. This was a conviction he couldn't explain.
Who was that man in his travels with Canaan? He stopped him from attacking a girl and just held him off?
That's the closest to physical combat he ever came to. He would use force to protect a weaker party. And you know how strong he was because he never hit this man, but he held him off the ground until he wore himself out, beating at the air.
Very strong.
But then when he started to... that was the time he just touched the fellow on the shoulder who had beaten his wife up. That was...
I said, my friend, may I ask you a question?
That was amazing.
This guy always had jacks or better. He could open any conversation. Progress is a lot of little things. Progress on earth is like finding the supreme being. We don't find the supreme being as an earthquake tears chasms in the rocks. We find the supreme being as the water quietly, slowly wears away the soil beneath. And if you want to get any idea of how important that can be when it's done for a long time, just go look at the Grand Canyon. That's been the work of a little river operating for a long time in the same bed. This water deal is a lot more sure than the earthquake deal. But we're always looking for earthquakes. We're impatient. We want it now.
The voice was not in thunder. There's a still, small voice.
Yes. And there's another thing, too. Who was it says that the challenge comes when you're seldom prepared for it? I don't think the 12 apostles were prepared to be apostles, but they became apostles, and Jesus made do with them. I don't think the people I know who are connected with this blue book are particularly well prepared. But as I look at the rest of my fellow men, I think we're about as well qualified as anybody. When I think of the weaknesses in the 12 apostles, I can live with mine. And such small ones as I see in you folks don't bother me too much. I mean, these 12 weren't very good business risks, I don't think. But this is, at any rate, here we are. Here we are, and we can accept life or the alternative, which is death. And if we accept life, well then, we have the free will choice of how we're going to live. And we can either be on the side of progress or we can ignore the whole ball of wax. And I think it's more fun to live adventurously with something like this blue book. I think you give more hostages to fate. I think you're much more vulnerable to sorrow and pain. But that's true if you fall in love or have children. You've really given some hostages to fate. And if you don't do these things, you live poorly. And if you do these things, you live richly. And I crave to live richly.
And nothing takes a place of experience.
Right, Julia. What is it they say that our civilization is being forged out between the anvils of anguish and the hammers of suffering? And you know, if they could figure a better way to forge it out, they would, but this way works. If we're beat on hard enough, we do move. We do something.
I get flattened out.
Sure. You know, all this controversy of the last century, did we descend from monkeys? Of course, that makes some sense from a genetic standpoint. But psychologically speaking, I think I'd have picked mules.
Yeah.
We're much more akin to mules than monkeys.
Or jackasses.
Yes.
Jack-eye, I'm sorry.
Jack-eye, that's the plural. I watched this Blue Book thing for quite a while. And I hope to be around and watch it for an equally long period. Maybe I'll be able to see 50 years worth of it. It's going about the way I thought it would. It's bumping along.
That's what your father said.
Yes.
Recently.
And we're a couple of societies behind the quota I thought we'd have by this time. We've got four. I thought at the end of 3 years we'd have about six.
Because the book got farther across the ocean than you thought by now.
Yes.
All the way to Australia.
Yes. It went all over the world faster than I thought it would, in a very thin way, you know, a copy here and a copy there. A copy up in Thule. You know, they got a map in Chicago with pins where there are books that are known.
What do you think it'll have 3 years from now?
Julia, I think we're going forward by quantum jumps.
You mean we level off?
And then jump, yes. I hope that when the first triennial Congress meets of delegates, geez, I hope there's at least 12 societies. It's going to look awful silly if four people meet in Chicago.
What year is that, Bill? We'll put that
four and a half years.
It's 4.5 years from now.
Let's see, 19.
This brotherhood is an autocratic organization for the first 9 years. And then at the end of 9 years, all the autocrats, I'm one of them, will resign, and their elected successors will take over, as they should. That'll be an interesting transitional period. And then if any society doesn't like what the Brotherhood's doing, they're to blame for it, because the societies will run the Brotherhood.
Bill, this really
is... As they should run the Brotherhood.
This really isn't too bad, comparing it to Swedenborg movement, which is about the same size right now, and that's been going for a long time.
Yes, that's right. Well, the book has... a lot higher voltage than Emmanuel was able to put in. He did pretty well for a guy.
Yeah.
But the Ancients of Days approved this, as you point out.
Mm-hmm.
I'd never looked at it that way.
Well, I have.
Well, can you truly measure the progress of the book by the number of societies, though? Perhaps many, many people read the book that will never want to join a society.
Julia, that point is well made. But when you look at an iceberg, what you're conscious of is what shows above water.
Yes, that's the only way we can measure.
That's right. We know there's a lot underwater.
Mm-hmm. Sure is. That's
equal,
especially
or more.
Now, just about.
Yes.
Come
yes.
Up, I think.
And so far, our societies don't have very much to attract people to come to them.
I think they should be made attractive.
That's the point.
Yes.
We agree.
I like the story of comparative religion. I've talked to a group in Chicago, and I've sounded them out. What would you like to do? The Blue Book is just one thing they want to do. But these people want to learn in general as well as learn about the Blue Book in particular.
And that's the only type of thing you could invite people to.
These people want a study group, and they want a forum on top of it. Now, if you're going to run a forum, and I suppose we will, it intrigues me, somebody's got to be able to moderate. And this means somebody's got to do a frightful amount of studying. And this means that somebody has got to stop being slothful. And that, of course, is your big challenge.
The group shouldn't be too big, because there are so people are so different and want different types of things that if your group is somewhat homogeneous,
yes,
you have so much.
But diversity is what makes a forum stimulating, I think.
To a certain extent, it bogs down and just won't move.
Let me describe to you several Urantia societies. Let's have the Stained Glass Urantia Society. This happens to be made up of a group of people who like stained glass. And if we tell them they can't have it, then we're setting ourselves up in a rather dictatorial position. This is a group of people who took a church over. The Blue Book got into the church, and finally it was put to a vote. And the Blue Bookites were in the majority, and the balance of the congregation withdrew and joined other churches. The Blue Bookites have a minister, and he's a Urantian. And they set up a society which is virtually synonymous with that church. Legally, they may have two separate organizations, or the society may own that church. And they have a service, and they have an altar call, and they have all the things that go along with a conventional service, only they teach from the Blue Book. Now, if we tell them they can't do that, then we are assuming some ecclesiastical authority which will destroy the brotherhood as a brotherhood. I think they have every right to do that, and I will fight for that right for them. I would like to visit that church and see how they do it. Because there are many people on earth who want just exactly that. And if we can get the Blue Book in place of the Bible, they've taken a tremendous step forward, because they're not going to teach the atonement, and they're going to get a lot of fear out of their religion. This is improvement, and I'll settle for improvement.
These are just hypothetical societies.
Yes. You want to know something? Julia, I'll bet you 10 to 1 this happens in our lifetime. Let's take another type of a society. This is the type that I would join. This type is Spartan in its austerity and Quaker-like in the absence of ritual. The first society has adopted some rituals. They shocked me. When I've been there, I've conformed. But I don't see that opening something with a prayer or closing it with a benediction means a bloody thing. I will not retain membership in the First Society forever. There are people who like to sing hymns. There will be societies where singing will be a feature of the service. This society, this is our third society, this society will attract people who grew up singing these hymns. I know that there is a good chunk of the members of the First Society who would like that.
Yes, I know it too.
Well, that's natural. And, that's their
right. I didn't grow up singing these hymns. These things are completely foreign.
What hymns will they sing?
Rock of Ages, and they'll rewrite.
Oh, you mean they'll sing Christian hymns?
Yeah, they'll unbloody them. They'll unbloody him. We'll get a good poet in there, and he'll write some new verses.
We had a group that wanted to take these, the ones that are in the book, and put them to music, and they worked pretty hard on it. So
sure.
That's a strong tendency.
Right.
And didn't I get the idea somewhere that two hymns that are now used traditionally, Joy to the World and Holy, 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 are from seraphic inspiration?
I know. Maybe so, Ruth. I don't know anything about that.
Somewhere I got that idea.
Now,
I can say singing.
This, of course. Now, here's a good example. The stained glass was a little shocking to Julia, but the hymns are not,
no,
because
so
that's her conditioning.
Back.
Right.
It's just our own conditioning.
She's got every right in the world to want this. And I will defend her right to have hymns, and I hope she defends my right not to have them. These are simply foreign to me. I never heard them.
That's why your group should be small.
I agree. Now,
well, maybe not.
Why couldn't this brotherhood?
Or at least somewhat homogeneous.
She means each group.
Why couldn't,
otherwise there's too much irritation.
Why couldn't this
control.
Brotherhood accommodate many different kinds of Urantia societies?
Yeah.
This is my ideal of the brotherhood. So that you could never go to any one place and say, this is the way it's got to be done.
Mm-hmm.
Why couldn't there be in Los Angeles, in time, 12 Urantia societies, ranging everywhere from the Quaker-like to the stained glass-like, and covering all points in between. This is what I'm interested in helping to promote.
And it never becomes stereotyped.
Yes. I'm interested in helping to promote the stained glass society. I want to help promote the hymn singing society. I want to promote and join the Quaker-like Spartan society.
Bill.
Do you follow me?
There's something about that, though, that right now isn't too good, because here we have one society.
I know.
We're trying to build
it up.
We're big
enough.
I was saying.
But look at it. We go up to, no, I'll sing. It might be flat, but I'll sing.
I would sing temporarily.
Well, look at it. We go up to somebody's door with a little harmonica and go, now can you follow me in this? No, well, you can't join our society. And then you go up to another guy and you say, please recite Voltaire's so-and-so.
That's
and if
right.
you can't do it, you can't join our yes. highly intellectual society. We got to be able to accept everyone.
Sure we do.
And that's right.
And later on, let these people sift themselves out into their homogeneous groups.
Right. We'll have to have two soundproof rooms. And get them split up, one with an organ and the other with a blackboard. That's all you can do.
You know,
I can. Group you're going to have?
Just the blue book, that's all.
I mean, would you have the Brotherhood in Chicago? Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's got your issues.
Sure.
I mean, you're going to have a...
From the standpoint of a social organization, you can accommodate all these people. Listen, I learned a great lesson when I was about 22 or 23. Was out at Panama Hills, Ruth. You remember those picnics we used to have? And I knew so little then that I was pretty sure I was right about most things. We were talking after the picnic, and I got up and made quite an idealistic speech on no symbols. And the fact that religion should be pure. And there was a gal there about 10 years older than me that I thought was quite a female, Connie Goldman, married to a captain up in Fort Sheridan. And I liked her very much. And she'd been raised as a Roman Catholic and had left the church. And she got up and made a plea for symbols. She said, they mean something to me. They help me. They help me visualize things. These are not idols. These are symbols. And as she talked, I got real, real small, you know, and realized that, sure, she should have her symbols. I shouldn't have to have her symbols, but I shouldn't take her symbols away from her. This thing has got to be broad, because these are not spiritual differences. These are differences in mind and temperament and background, and we're all different in these respects.
Be a member of something that more or less suits us. We've got to be awfully patient,
yes.
tolerant, and unresentful.
Yes. That's right. In time, we can articulate. Yes. But right now, if we articulate, we're going to be just a bunch of individuals. There is a value to group activities. This is not a substitute for religion. But the structure of this brotherhood provides some banks, and if you don't have banks, you don't have a river. And these are designed to be the least harmful banks that will still serve as banks so that a river can flow. Otherwise, you have a swamp. When you run out of banks, you run into the problem you hit in Lower Louisiana. Have you ever flown over that area? And it's pretty hard to tell whether it's land or water. The upper Mississippi is a more attractive thing. And that's why I'm working hard, you know, filling sandbags and working on the banks. I think we need these banks. But I don't worship them. They're simply useful. Without them, we can't have a river. It's the river I'm interested in, but I can't build a river. I can only build banks.
How about the life on the neighboring planet where they have the big school of philosophy? Wouldn't we, at a place like that, we could have the Blue Book exactly, but...
We don't have the school of philosophy to back it up.
No,
we don't have the government to go out. That life on a neighboring planet, to me, is an ideal religion. Here is where the only altar is the family heart. Hope at that future time, we can show them so many different kinds of society that it will be almost impossible to stereotype this, so that we can say, look, we do it in a lot of different ways. Here, let's go over, we'll take you to the stained glass society. And they'll say, well, gee, this is very much like a Christian church. We'll say, isn't it interesting? Yes. We'll take him to the hymn singing society, no stained glass. We'll take him to a place that looks very much like a classroom. And we'll say, no, look, this is the way we've done it, because we don't think these things are too important. How do you want to do it? Well, I'll say we want a mosque society. We want a society where we have a tower. And three times a day, we want to have a reader. And he gets up in the tower and he calls the faithful. And when we come in, we want to take our shoes off because it seems unseemly to study things sacred with your shoes on. And we want to sit down and we want to be read to. And we don't want any pictures in there because we're not used to pictures in our places of worship. And we will say to these Mohammedans, fine, you set up the mosque, your ancient society, and follow along in accordance with your tradition. And there may be another contemplative society. Maybe they'll say, we want our custodian of our temple to wear yellow robes. And we don't want much noise in there because we want to come in and read the book quietly and pray. We'll say, fine, why don't you set up the Buddhist Urantia Society? You talk about the differences. We haven't begun to see the differences that will be attracted to this book. And if we can build wisely, we will build something which is so flexible, so tolerant, so broad, that it will accommodate all of the boss's kids with their different outlooks, their different customs, their different ways of doing things. I'm not thinking about just small differences in a little group like this. I'm trying to think ahead to the whole darn planet, because this book is for the planet. And I know Los Angeles, it covers most of the world, but there are a few regions outside of the city limits still.
There's New York, you know.
Yeah.
We're going to annex that next
week. The forum was conducted like a Christian Science church, as much as any church I can think of, because two readers get up. We're trained to read. Yes. The Christian Science church would go in, it's very
right.
quiet, and sit down. That's the way we used to do it at your
yes,
house.
I know.
We'd all sit down quietly, and readers who were trained to read, probably the better readers, would read to us.
The forum grew up and followed a tradition. My dad set the tradition and I perpetuated it for 20 years.
It's as much like a Christian Science mm-hmm. service as I can think of.
But we had a ritual. We had a ritual. I used to make the most of it. We had a chime gizmo. You know, you could play bugle calls on it. And I used to play different Marine Corps bugle calls to call the faithful after the intermission for the second hour. I used to play Liberty Call and Chow Bumps and Payday and Sick Call and Call to Arms and all that sort of thing. And I told them very solemnly that if this wasn't played just right, nothing in the second hour would count and the whole thing was for naught. Because it says in the blue book here that if you deviate by a hair's turning from the ritual, the spirits will not be propitiated. So we had a ritual back there. We always rang the gong between the first and second halves.
Something of just playing efficiency in that. It's like a bell for school.
You develop rituals. Jesus tried to completely de-ritualize the prayer life of his brothers and sisters. And out of it, we got one of the most beautiful rituals that's ever evolved, the Lord's Prayer, which we all like. Now at that point, I go for a little ritual. That's something we can say together, if we want to say something together.
Well, part of ritual takes the place of organization to eliminate confusion.
Yeah.
That's right.
And
that's
you need
right.
some of it to allow for the creative side.
Yeah.
It's like school.
Yeah.
We have to have a little organization so that children are free to create.
Right.
And think creatively.
Ruth, do they still follow the ritual I set up in the executive committee? Do you still recess to discuss
yes.
questions?
Well, there is much more discussion after each section.
I see. No. I mean in the executive committee of the Brotherhood.
Oh, yes, that's the same.
We ritualized our meeting for
yes,
convenience.
Yes, that's the same. Absolutely.
I tried to think out what's the most
the
efficient
very
way.
Efficient thing, that is.
When we met very formally. I called a meeting to order. We read the minutes. And the minutes were read because we said we read them in the next minutes. We did everything we said we did. And then I said, the chair will entertain a motion to recess for a discussion of questions. Motion so made, seconded, carried. We're in recess. Robert's rules of orders don't apply now, just politeness. And then we would discuss everything, and if necessary, I'd dictate to Marion a gist of the discussion for the minutes. And we would discover that we had two motions to make to complete our business. And while we're still in recess, everybody has the motion. We know who's going to make the motion, who's going to second it. Then I call the meeting to order. Motion number one was made, second and passed. Motion number two was made, second and passed. We entertain the motion to adjourn. We adjourn. So the first 3 minutes and the last 3 minutes of our meeting were rigidly formal. And everything else, we could do business.
Yeah, you Stoics wouldn't object to plan, but if we call it ritual, then you'd object.
No, there's got to be ritual.
Well, that's what
I know that. Yeah, ritual is bad semantics with me.
Yeah.
I'm an anti-ritualer who leans in the direction of ritual because I know I'm out of order with the human race. No, you analyze the ritual that Ruth's committee devised for taking in members. If you're going to have a ritual, that's about as clean and simple a ritual as you can have. You can't object to that. It's an orderly procedure. And it provides for adding as much more as any society wants. Gee, you can pile that whipped cream pretty deep on that little plate if you want it. You can pray, you can invoke, you can intone.
I'm saying.
Yeah, that's up to the society.
You can lay down prostrate for a couple
sure,
hours.
You can roll on the floor if you want to. Yeah. You know when the two movements of the Jesus Brotherhood merged, John's movement and Jesus' movement, they had quite a hassle. Does anybody know where that is real quick, like?
I was after the death of John, wasn't it?
I know it was.
I think it's right after that paper of John the Baptist.
No.
No.
Because then it picks up Jesus' story. Yeah. Oh, look at the table contents.
Is that from the All Went
On
to Jesus? Three days before that.
Yeah. I want to refresh our memories on what Jesus told them.
I like where they were, instead of repent and be baptized, they compromised and said believe and be baptized.
Mm-hmm.
They merged the two.
1624,
did you say?
Yeah. Well, that's the conference of John's apostles.
1624, is it?
Right. Well, that's the conference.
Yeah. All right, let's see what that says. Yes. The beginning of the second week of this month, Abner had assembled all of his associates at the Gilboa camp and was prepared to go into council with the apostles of Jesus. For 3 weeks, these 24 men were in session three times a day, and for 6 days each week. The first, I want to, you know, a tape of that session would be fascinating.
Page
1624. The first week, Jesus mingled with them between their forenoon, afternoon, and evening sessions. They wanted the master to meet with them and preside over their joint deliberations, but he steadfastly refused to participate in their discussions, though he did consent to speak to them on three occasions. These talks by Jesus to the 24 were on sympathy, cooperation, and tolerance. And if he were here today, he wouldn't participate in any of our discussions about how to run a group. Because just think what a terrible thing it would be if he approved somebody's plan. Forevermore, we'd be afraid ever to deviate from that plan. And there is no right plan. There is no one right way of doing this, I believe. There are many ways that will appeal to many people. Sympathy, cooperation, and tolerance. And that's what y'all need. Getting started is sympathy, cooperation, and tolerance.
One reason the executive committee hesitates so much to sanction certain pamphlets and not others.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point.
They'll be regarded too seriously.
Yeah, that's a good point.
They'll be taken too much as tradition.
Yeah, this came from Rome.
And they don't want
This came from
trying to avoid that, and of course the very lack of it makes societies feel awfully neglected.
Sure. Well, the executive committee is trying to do what Jesus did in teaching his brothers and sisters to pray.
But that's the reason.
It'll probably wind up doing something. There's another reason too, Ruth, and that is it's awful hard work to do stuff like that.
Yeah.
And the Brotherhood is made up of human beings.
Very heterogeneous.
That's right. That's right. I've had an evolution in my own thinking. I had 3 years sitting right in the middle of the Brotherhood at Chicago. I've had about 2 years of getting awfully well acquainted with some societies and things outside, and it's helped me get two viewpoints. In other words, I've acquired a society's viewpoint, and I still have what I learned when I was president of the Brotherhood, and I know how puzzled they can be in Chicago. Distance lends enchantment, and the distance of Chicago adds to the stature of all the people in Chicago. But you know, they're folks just like we are here in Los Angeles.
Very short.
Sympathy, cooperation, and tolerance. Wasn't he wise? He wouldn't sit with them. For a week he lubricated things between the sessions. And then he went away. Let's see what happened. Andrew and Abner alternated in presiding over these joint meetings of the two apostolic groups. These men had many difficulties to discuss and numerous problems to solve. Again and again would they take their troubles to Jesus, only to hear him say, "I am concerned only with your personal and purely religious problems. I am the representative of the Father to the individual, not to the group. If you are in personal difficulty in your relations with God, come to me, and I will hear you and counsel you in the solution of your problem. But when you enter upon the coordination of divergent human interpretations of religious questions and upon the socializing of religion, you are destined to solve all such problems by your own decisions. Albeit, I am ever sympathetic and always interested. And when you arrive at your conclusions touching these matters of non-spiritual import, provided you are all agreed, then I pledge in advance my full approval and hearty cooperation. And now, in order to leave you unhampered in your deliberations, I am leaving you for 2 weeks. Be not anxious about me, for I will return to you. I will be about my Father's business, for we have other realms besides this one." Jesus refused to have anything to do with this meeting, but he called the meeting. Jesus knew that these two groups had to get together. He brought them together. He was not vitally concerned with what they decided. He hoped they'd be unanimous. He refused to participate, but he initiated this meeting. Jesus knew they had to have an organization. And Jesus knew that he was not going to design it, because he didn't have to. This is something which men can do. Men can't reveal God, but men can build organizations. Jesus called this meeting.
They got their emblem in, at least, that was baptism.
Yes.
Baptizing.
That was the price.
The adoption of prayer.
That was the price which was paid. Jesus 12 had to buy baptism in order to get John's movement. John's 12 bought everything else. In the afternoon of their final discussion of financial questions, Jesus returned, heard of their deliberations, listened to their decisions, and said, "These then are your conclusions, and I shall help you each to carry out the spirit of your united decisions." And I think that's exactly the way he feels today about what we're trying to do here on earth. He's very interested in what we're doing. I don't think his spirit of truth will participate in these things. But I think he'll try to help us carry out whatever plan we adopt. Let's have a coffee break, what do you say?
I would love that.
Around there.
Well, we've had some good talk, and I can't find the quote I'm looking for. Oh, it has to do with the with what the world today needs in terms of a religious organization.
Oh, I can get you that.
There's a real place for people if they'll go at it this way.
And they don't need
is this Foundations of Religious Faith?
I just went through those four papers and I can't find it. I'm looking in After Pentecost now.
Mm-hmm. Yes, why don't?
Yeah.
Oh, you know what to do with it, don't you? 10% chlorox in water. It's painful, but it stops it.
I've used Lysol through the years.
Lysol doesn't do good. Well, this chlorox will stop the cut the oil.
Have you started it your own weldy and?
Like this. Here. This is poison.
Oh, yes.
Just 10% chlorox. It just cuts the oil. That's well. Poison oak's just an irritating oil.
I see that.
Just
getting here.
Bill, it would be in that future of 2084,
right?
2084?
The future
of chlorox.
It's
painful.
No. I have a feeling I'm not going to find it. No, I can't.
It wouldn't be around that series on 1100 and something. Revelation versus evolution.
Yeah, that's a possibility.
1106. Real
that's
nature
a possibility.
Of religion. 1104. We're starting.
I scanned those four papers.
Mm-hmm. One of my favorites.
Which would spiritually unite and loving service the numerous families of the present day.
Read it, Julia.
The great hope of your answer lies in the possibility of a new revelation of Jesus with a new and enlarged presentation of his saving message, which would spiritually unite in loving service the numerous families of his present day professed followers, 2086. Then there's some more above all of that.
Is that what you were looking for, Bill?
No, but it's getting close.
What?
Well, there's some more on that page.
What were you looking for? Is it under a heading or something?
No.
Some more about.
It's a. I can find it if I have to, because I put it in my triennial report and I've got the citation there.
Oh, I have your annual report.
Yeah, loan it to me, will you? That's a heck of a thing. I have to go look up something I wrote and quoted the papers in order to find what I'm looking for. A specific statement, I usually know where it is, but a general statement could be so many places in the book.
I realize that.
Oh, thanks, Julia.
Did I give you one, Betty?
Yes,
I think
thank you.
Wonderful.
I read it.
Everybody else has one. Isn't it good?
Yes, it's very good. That's the one that came out quite well.
1487.
Yeah.